It is important that I emphasise, as did Dr. Wilkinson, that the violent Islamist extremists are a tiny group who have adopted a distorted view of Islam based on an incorrect interpretation of the Quran. Dr. Wilkinson outlined what he believed were the various influences that had contributed to Salman Abedi's radicalization. He concluded that by 2017, every conceivable radicalizing malign presence and noxious absence existed in Salman Abedi's life. He said, "I have never seen such a complete picture of the Petri dish absolutely brimming with germs." I consider that Dr. Wilkinson's evidence was important. His perspective of the significance of behaviours exhibited by Salman Abedi was on occasions different from that of the security service and counter-terrorism policing. I would hope that his evidence will be considered with care by the relevant authorities to see what knowledge can be gained to assist in the correct identification of individuals who are at risk of being radicalised. I have concluded that there were a number of contributing factors to Salman Abedi's radicalisation. His family background and his parents' extremist views, along with their participation in the struggle in Libya, played a significant part. That struggle involved people who were radical, violent extremists. During the time Salman Abedi and Hashim Abedi spent in Libya, during which they were probably involved in fighting, they are likely to have come into contact with a number of violent extremists. It is likely that those extremists, including members of the Islamic State, who would be in a position to provide the brothers with expertise in making of bombs and in carrying out counter-surveillance measures. As leading counsel for the inquiry said during one of the hearings, how was someone of Salman Abedi's limited intelligence and abilities able to succeed in committing this atrocity despite any safeguards which were in place? The likely answer is he was provided with help. I have not been able to obtain a complete picture of the part Salman Abedi and Hashim Abedi's family played in their radicalisation, nor of what happened while they were in Libya. That is because other members of their family, namely their parents and brother, were not willing to give evidence to the inquiry. Salman and Hashim's parents were invited to provide statements, but declined to do so. As they are currently out of the jurisdiction, there were no further steps that I could take. Ismail Abedi, who was in the country at the time I requested a statement, managed to leave the United Kingdom so that he didn't have to provide information which he was in a position to give. I have included in the recommendations section of Volume 3 some suggestions which I hope will make this more difficult for important witnesses in the future. Whether, if I had succeeded in getting Ismail Abedi into the witness box, he would have assisted the inquiry is very doubtful. What I was not prepared to do in the circumstances of this case was to invite the Attorney General to grant him immunity from prosecution in relation to any evidence he gave to me, in order to encourage him to speak. If he was involved in the plot, it would be quite wrong for him to have any protection from prosecution and punishment. There were other extremists, most of whom came from the same area of Manchester as Salman Abedi, and probably played a part in Salman Abedi's radicalisation, and or confirming him in his views once he had committed to violent extremism. One of those is Abdul Rauf Abdullah. A series of messages, over 1,000 in number, between Abdul Rauf Abdullah and Salman Abedi, sent during November 2014, were recovered as part of Operation Oliban, which was the counter-terrorism policing investigation which resulted in the prosecution and conviction of Abdul Rauf Abdullah for terrorist offences. Those messages talk of martyrdom. They were highly significant in the view of Dr. Wilkinson, as demonstrating the influence that Abdul Rauf Abdullah had over Salman Abedi and the development of his violent extremist mindset. Salman Abedi was not identified as one of the participants in this exchange of messages until after the attack, and I have concluded, on the balance of probabilities, the messages were not passed to the security service by counter-terrorism policing as they should have been. My investigations, however, have demonstrated that even if Salman Abedi had been identified and the messages had been sent to the security service, it would not have affected their view of Salman Abedi. I have not criticised that view taken by the security service, but there is a learning point which could usefully be pursued, which is that the attitude of the security service to those sort of messages might be informed by the considerations which Dr. Wilkinson applied. We know that Salman Abedi visited Abdul Rauf Abdullah in prison, and also that they communicated by phone, including by use of an illegal mobile phone which Abdul Rauf Abdullah had in prison. It was apparent from the evidence that while prisons were alert to the problem of known radicalizers influencing other prisoners, they paid little, if any, attention to the risk that such prisoners, who may have had a hero status to some, would take the opportunity to radicalize visitors or encourage those who were already radicalized in their beliefs. There is no evidence that Abdul Rauf Abdullah played any part in plotting the attack, but it is likely, in my view, that he provided support for Salman Abedi's ideological beliefs and increased Salman Abedi's resolve to carry out the attack. It is important that the prison authorities do take notice of the risks that those in prison for terrorist offences, such as encouraging others to go and fight abroad, may seek to radicalise their visitors as well as other prisoners, or at least support their radical views. The government's response to the risks of radicalisation is the PREVENT programme. A review of that programme by William Shawcross has just been published, and the government has responded to it. Because of that report, I did not carry out an assessment of the effectiveness of the PREVENT programme during my inquiry. It would have been beyond my terms of reference to do so. The Shawcross report does deal with issues of the Abedis and PREVENT, and notes that neither of them were referred to PREVENT. The Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament noted the same thing with surprise. I have looked in detail at the various occasions when Salman Abedi could have been referred to PREVENT. I have concluded that he should have been. I heard evidence that his referral was considered at one stage, but he was not considered suitable. There can be no guarantee that Salman Abedi or Hashim Abedi would have agreed to participate in the PREVENT programme. Their elder brother, Ishmael, refused to engage in any way with counter-terrorism policing officers when they went to speak to him in 2015. I have concluded that there was at least a period during Salman Abedi's journey to violent extremism when he should have been referred to the programme. It is very hard to say what then might have happened. I have looked at whether the various educational establishments and mosques that Salman Abedi attended should have appreciated that he was moving towards violent extremism and notified the relevant authorities. I consider that it would have been very difficult for any of the educational establishments to have become aware of his developing extremism. One of the problems that I have identified is that while over the period of his education at different establishments, Salman Abedi showed worrying signs which could have been related to extremist views, there is no record which goes with the student which would allow anybody to consider all those signs together. Having a record which passes from school with a student to college or university may well be contentious, and deciding what material to include would also be difficult. Nevertheless, I do consider that it is something which should be looked at to see if a solution can be found. Another very contentious part of the evidence concerned the Manchester Islamic Centre, also known as the Didsbury Mosque, which Salman Abedi attended on some occasions. I consider it unlikely, having considered all the evidence, that Salman Abedi was radicalised at the Didsbury Mosque. But some of the evidence given on behalf of the mosque about the association of the Abedi family with the mosque was unsatisfactory. It looked as if the Didsbury Mosque was trying to distance itself from the Abedi family in a way which I did not accept was accurate. The reality, in my view, was that the Didsbury Mosque did have a significant number of attendees who were connected to Libya, but were attached to opposite sides in the conflict. Didsbury Mosque tried and largely succeeded in providing a broad church where both sides of the conflict could worship together. Although conflicts were generally avoided, this did on occasions lead to tensions between the two sides. The evidence given on behalf of the Didsbury Mosque could have been more helpful in enabling me to get to the truth. The Charity Commission has already prescribed a programme that the Didsbury Mosque must put in place. I hope that they will read my report and consider whether anything more needs to be done. For reasons that I have already given, I have not commented on the effectiveness of PREVENT as a programme. It should be noted, however, that during my inquiry, several senior police officers spoke highly of it as a programme and how successful it can be in some cases. William Shawcross did comment on the radicalisation of Salman Abedi in his report. He did not have the benefit, as I did, of an intensive investigation into Salman Abedi's case, nor did he have the benefit of hearing from witnesses in closed session in order to resolve contentious issues. Insofar as William Shawcross's short passage in his report dealing with Salman Abedi does not agree entirely with the conclusions that I have reached, I would suggest that this is because of the much greater opportunity that I have had to listen to and test the evidence. Planning and preparation. While this part of my report is largely a narrative of events, it is nevertheless important. It is important that what was done by Salman Abedi and Hashim Abedi in preparation for the attack is understood in detail. Only by doing that is it possible to understand where the weaknesses are in the provisions that try to prevent people acquiring the necessary ingredients for a bomb and information about how to construct it. It is important that the opportunities for obtaining precursor chemicals are as limited as possible without preventing entirely innocent members of the public conducting their lives without undue difficulty. This part of the report is based almost entirely on the work of the Operation Manteline team, to whom I am very grateful. This investigation into the attack conducted by Greater Manchester Police was, as far as I am concerned, of a very high quality. It resulted in the conviction of Hashim Abedi for the murder of the 22 people who died and the attempted murder of many more who attended that night. I am as satisfied as I can be that the brothers made use of an instructional video placed on the internet by the so-called Islamic State to create their bomb. As much as possible needs to be done by the authorities to ensure that instructions for murder, such as these, are not put on the internet, and if they are, they remain there for the minimum amount of time. Further, it is important that the regulations requiring the reporting of unusual sales of precursor chemicals are continually kept under review and are as stringent as possible. That is not easy to achieve, and it needs to be made clear that unusual purchases need to be reported promptly. None of the purchases of precursor chemicals obtained by the brothers were reported to the authorities. That is a situation which should not have arisen. Had they been reported, it is possible that Salman Abedi could have been stopped. I have considered the parts played by others in the obtaining of those precursor chemicals and other acts which assisted the brothers in their preparation. All of this was carefully investigated by the police as part of Operation Manteline, and the evidence was reviewed by the Crown Prosecution Service to consider whether prosecutions could be brought. Some of the people are still under police investigation, but so far no further prosecutions have been brought. The issue in almost every case is whether the person who in fact provided help to the brothers in their preparations can be proved to have known what they were providing help for. There will inevitably be suspicion, and in some cases there will be more suspicion than in others. It is not my job to review the charging decisions of the police or the Crown Prosecution Service, but for what it is worth, I agree with the decisions that they have made. I do not consider it is appropriate for me to accuse individuals of serious criminal offence where they can't be proved to the appropriate criminal standard. So I have not gone further than setting out the way in which various individuals assisted the brothers. I am confident that if evidence is found which justifies the prosecution, then the police and the Crown Prosecution Service will take the appropriate action. Preventability. Finally, in my report, I deal with the issue of whether the attack should or could have been prevented by the Security Service and counter-terrorism policing. I have reported fully on those matters in the closed part of Volume 3 of my report, which will be seen by those who are best placed to ensure that mistakes which were made are not repeated. In the open part of Volume 3, I have included all matters which I can safely include without jeopardising national security and making our community less safe. I have set out how I have approached the issue of national security, and I shall not repeat it now, except to say that where it has been possible, without risking national security, to make public the evidence that I heard enclosed, I have done so. What I have been able to set out in the open part of Volume 3 is that I have found a significant missed opportunity to take action that might have prevented the attack. It is not possible to reach any conclusion on the balance of probabilities or to any other evidential standard as to whether the attack would have been prevented. However, there was a realistic possibility that actionable intelligence could have been obtained which might have led to actions preventing the attack. The reasons for this missed opportunity included a failure by the Security Service, in my view, to act swiftly enough. I am aware that revealing what I have revealed in Part 24 of my report will leave many people, and particularly the bereaved families, wanting to know more. All I can say is that I have done my best to reveal what I can. Had we not had closed hearings, I would not have been able to make the findings that I have been able to make. Closed hearings, I am convinced, were entirely necessary as part of this inquiry if it was going to achieve its aims. The consequence of that, however, is that I have not been able to reveal some of the evidence on which my findings are based, as to do so would have risked breaching national security. While I have been critical of some of the ways that the Security Service and counter-terrorism police dealt with the information that they had or could have had in this case, I also recognise the very difficult job they have to do, and I acknowledge their success in uncovering a large number of plots against people in this country. I will make a number of closed recommendations to try and ensure that improvements are made in the way that the security service and counter-terrorist policing deal with the intelligence that they get. While I intend to monitor the recommendations in the open Volume 3, I consider that the Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament are the most suitable body to monitor any closed recommendations that I make. They have already investigated the attack and made recommendations. They are in the best position to take an overall view and ensure the steps are taken to make improvements. They also have the important benefit that they will be in a position to carry on their monitoring over a long period of time. Because this is my final open report, I have set out my gratitude to all the people who have worked so hard on this report. The lawyers, the organisations who have responded to endless requests for information, those behind the scenes who have enabled the inquiry to keep going even in difficult situations, and I include in that the providers of the technology which has made it so much easier to conduct this inquiry. And of course I thank the many, many witnesses who have given evidence to me. All have worked very hard. I am personally especially grateful to counsel and solicitors to the inquiry, without whose expertise I could not have completed what has been a very onerous task. Generally, in conducting this inquiry, I have been greatly impressed and grateful for the genuine intention and aspiration held by so many to make a difference and to try and ensure that nothing like the Manchester Arena attack ever happens again. Some of the evidence has been inspirational, showing humanity at its best. Some of it, when recounting the activities of Salman and Hashim Abedi, has shown humanity at its worst. A significant part of the evidence heard by this inquiry has been grueling and distressing to listen to. For example, the evidence of people who were there, did their best to help, who will be affected for the rest of their lives by what they saw and heard. The evidence of the bereaved families, of the effect that the deaths of their loved ones has had on their lives. And who could fail but be moved by the tributes of the families to those who died? Those who were young were so full of promise. Those who were older were achieving that promise. And all of them were the cornerstones of their families. What an appalling loss, which was so unnecessary. Amongst all that grief, we should try and remember the positives as well, along with the terrible events. The courage of members of the public and many members of the rescue services who did their best to help in appalling circumstances. The response of Manchester as it came together after the attack to support all those who'd been affected. And the efforts of the bereaved families and survivors to try and make something good come out of tragedy in their varied and different ways. I am especially grateful to the bereaved families for their continuous support throughout the inquiry. It is impossible to imagine how difficult it must have been for them to listen to some of the evidence that we have heard. I have not been able to answer all of the questions that they wanted answered, and I am aware that in my open report on Volume 3, I have raised more questions in their mind. I am sorry, but that was inevitable. I did ask the questions. I did get answers. But for the reasons I have given, I have not been able to report publicly what those answers were. It has been an enormous responsibility, as well as a privilege, to conduct this inquiry. I can only hope that we achieve something by our efforts. That will only happen if those away from this inquiry can share in the desires of those who have taken part in it to make things better. Inevitably, some of the changes that are needed will require money, which is in short supply. But protecting the lives of the people of this country must be a high priority for any government. Thank you.
And that was the statement from Sir John Saunders, chairman of the inquiry from Manchester Hall, speaking there for around about 30 minutes.